Distributing the Future broadcast March 15, 2006, The Internet of Things.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. This week we feature Bruce Sterling's keynote address from last week's Emerging Technology Conference. Distributing the Future is brought to you by GoToMeeting. Host your meeting online with GoToMeeting. Everyone logs into your meeting during your conference call, so they see your computer desktop on their computer screen. It's just like meeting in person, but less expensive and time-consuming. With GoToMeeting, you can demo products, present, or train just like you're in the same room. GoToMeeting has a low, flat monthly rate, so meet as often as you want for as long as you need. Try it free today at gotomeeting.com/DTF. That's gotomeeting.com/DTF. This is a bit of an unusual edition of Distributing the Future. Our only segment this week is an edited version of Bruce Sterling's address, The Internet of Things, from the Emerging Technology Conference. Sterling looked ahead at a future in which ubiquitous computing becomes a reality. As an author of science fiction, he's comfortable with looking 30 or more years into the future. In addition to his thoughts on where technology is going, Sterling goes to great lengths to underline the importance of the names we give to the technology. He wonders, for example, how much we hampered and limited ourselves by using the name computer and thinking in terms of intelligence. His entire address was more than twice the length of what we're presenting here. It will appear at some point as part of IT Conversations. Often these hour-long addresses are edited down to 8-minute segments for this program. The best we could do in Sterling's case was to cut it down to roughly 27 minutes. In his introduction, author Cory Doctorow describes Sterling as a machine for inspiring geeks. Sterling begins by considering the Internet of Things a reality that he doesn't see in the next few years, but rather one that he sees coming into being decades from now. As he says,
in about 30 years, I might well wake up surrounded by internet-linked electronic barcodes, and I might well say to myself, wow, look, I am in an Internet of Things situation. But at the moment, to this historical moment, we are still eagerly debating the proper terminology for an Internet of Things. Now, if you want to talk about Web 2.0, you have some advantages. You can say things like Flickr, Wikipedia, which, you know, aren't real words, but they're things you can point at. You might meet Jimmy Wales or Katarina Fake, who are not futurists, but actual working web technologists. You know, Web 2.0 is kind of a loose grab bag of concepts. But Jimmy Wales isn't a loose grab bag. I mean, Jimmy Wales physically exists. And in the case of an Internet of Things or ubiquitous computation, the top guru in that field, Mark Weiser of Xerox PARC, has been dead for several years now. When it comes to remote technical eventualities, you don't want to freeze your language too early. Because otherwise you're trying to freeze a technology into the shape of today's verbal descriptions, and that prejudices people. It's bad attention economics because it limits their ability to find and understand the intrinsic advantages of the technology. Now, one good example of freezing the language too early, I think, is artificial intelligence. We very early got into the lasting bad habit of referring to computers as thinking machines. Now, I suspect this metaphor seriously harmed technical development in computers. Even the word computing sounds too much like human arithmetical thinking. We might have made a much better language choice if we had called computers something like the French call them, ordinateurs, ordinators. Computers are not smart in any useful sense of that term. They don't think. They don't have any intelligence. Computers do not know things. They don't have any literal memories. They're not alive. They are just sitting there ordinating. Now, what is ordinating? Well, if we'd invested our attention in figuring that out, Instead of awkwardly struggling for years to make these devices think like a human brain does, then we would have successfully explored the very large set of interesting problems that computers turned out to be really good at. Now, if you look at today's potent, influential computer technologies like, say, Google, you're looking at something that seems artificially intelligent by the visionary standards of the 1960s, because Google seems to know pretty much everything about you and me. Big brother, Google is like Colossus the Forbin Project in a lot of ways. But Google is not designed or presented as a thinking machine. Google is not like Ask Jeeves or Microsoft Bob, those two fictions which horribly pretend to think and would not fool a five-year-old child. Google is a search engine. It's a linking, ranking, and sorting machine. Now, linking, ranking, and sorting, they may not sound very sexy, glamorous, or philosophically crucial compared to intelligence, but instead of nostalgically clinging to the words, these neologisms of the past, which are now archaeologisms, we should pay more attention to the facts on the ground. I mean, what works? What matters? When I think hard about it, do I really want some classical artificial intelligence that can talk to me just like Alan Turing? Or do I prefer Google? I mean, imagine two startup companies. One of them has got Alan Turing's disembodied talking head inside a box, but no search engines. And then the other company, they have no AI, but they get to use Google. I guess you could argue that Alan Turing's super smart metal head might invent Google, but do you need this roundabout approach? All it takes is a couple of grad students to invent Google. And after doing that, the folksonomy kicks in, so you get all the linking and ranking and sorting more or less for free. So you can keep Alan Turing in your box, and I'll even throw in Richard Feynman. They can artificially think, but the rest of us will be getting on with the revolution. Now, was it the words that misled us? I think it was the words, yes. I think we could have done better words. Now, imagine that back in the days of mainframe punch card computers, some genius tech commentator had shown up. And he looks at the earliest computers and he sensibly says, well, wait a minute, even if there is like Boolean logic going on here, this machine has got nothing to do with any actual thinking because this machine is clearly a big card shuffler. It's a linker, a stacker, and a sorter. It's got stiff paper cards, and some of the cards have marks on them that can lead to other cards. So it's not best called a thinking machine or even a computer because doing sums is not the crucial issue here. Now, a tech world that chose to talk about ordinators instead of artificial intelligence probably would have produced Google in about 1980. The digital devices that people carry around with them now, laptops, media players, camera phones, PDAs, wireless and wired, local and global networks that serve people in varying locations as they and their objects and possessions and data physically move around the world. We'd think about it better if this class of object had its own name. So I call that object, an object like that, a spine, because an object like that is trackable in space and time. Now, why do we need a new word for a concept of that kind? Because the old words distract our attention. Spines are manufactured objects whose informational support is so extensive and rich that they are regarded as material instantiations of an immaterial system. Spines begin and end as data. They are virtual objects first and actual objects second. Now, why would we want to do such a strange thing? Mostly so that we can engage with objects better during their entire life cycle, from the moment of their invention to their decay. That's the technical reason, the design reason. But the real reason we would want to do that is because of how it would feel. The primary advantage of an Internet of Things is that I no longer inventory my possessions inside my own head. They are inventoried through an auto-magical inventory voodoo, work done far beneath my notice by a host of machines. So I no longer bother to remember where I put things, or where I found them, or how much they cost, and so forth. I just ask. Then I am told, with instant real-time accuracy, I have an Internet of Things with a search engine of things. So I no longer hunt anxiously for my missing shoes in the morning. I just Google them. As long as machines can crunch the complexities, their interfaces make my relationship to objects feel much more simple and more immediate. I am at ease in materiality in a way that people never were before. Okay, now this is what I'm talking about here. Not a smart object that is ubiquitously computing. I mean the everyday object. The dumbest, cheapest, most obvious thing we can buy or use. Except it has a unique digital identity. So it's become trackable, sortable, rankable, findable in space and time. And when I put on some kind of hot tag, we can have a point of discussion. Oh. You mean that everyday object? You say, well, I've got the same one as you, only mine is better. Why? Because my everyday object is actually tomorrow's emerging object. Really? No way. Yes way. I have tomorrow's emerging object 2.0. And I can prove that. Just listen to all my friends in the web. And where'd you get your spine? You got it out of your super Erebone ports high security spime shipping container. Now, when they work well, new words like spime are like new brooms. They're particularly good for getting rid of the old words, which have turned into dust. Now, I could have called my speech tonight Everywhere, like Adam Greenfield calls his new book, instead of calling my speech Internet of Things, like MIT does. Now I'll explain why I didn't choose to use that term. I'm going to quote from an interview with him now. And the interviewer asks him, "Everywhere has a lot in common with the contemporary discourses of ubiquitous computing. So why coin an entirely new word?" And Adam Greenfield replies, "Each of the terms already in use, ubicomp, pervasive computing, tangible media, physical computing, and so on, is contentious. They're associated with one or another viewpoint, institution, funding source, or dominant personality. I wanted people relatively new to these ideas to be able to have a rough container for them so that they could be discussed without anyone getting bogged down in internecine definitional struggles like, such and such a system has a tangible interface, but that isn't really ubicomp." Now, I kind of admire this term, everywhere. It's certainly more elegant than ubicomp, which is really a verbal disaster as a noun in the English language. Or ubiquitous computation, which takes forever to say and is hard to spell. Now, I think that everywhere is somewhat confusing in verbal speech because it's a pun, everywhere. And if you Google the term everywhere, you find there's already a rather flourishing company named Everywhere. My main critique of this term is that I'm not sure it carries enough new freight with it. It's a much nicer name for the older grab bag, ubicomp, everywhere. Has this word been prematurely optimized? Will this word scale upward when we start really understanding this emergent technology? Now, personally, I don't believe that ubiquitous computation, as eventually seen in real life, will turn out to be ubiquitous or computation. I don't think those are the important things about it. So I don't think it really will be everywhere. I think it's going to be patchy and limited, in much the same way that cell phone cells and RFID tags are patchy and limited. I think it's about sorting, tagging, searching, ranking, and researching instead of being a smooth, finished product like a state-supported Ma Bell universal access utility. Time will tell. But in the meantime, before time is told, you don't want to avoid the contentiousness of those definitional struggles, exactly because they really are associated with the viewpoints, the institutions, the funding sources, and the dominant personalities. The words are the signifiers for a clash of sensibilities that really needs to clash. Otherwise, you're trying to wallpaper the wall while it's still undergoing construction. Now, let me give you a cogent example of how this works. Let's take Web 2.0. Here we've got the canonical Tim O'Reilly definition of Web 2.0. I'm going to quote him here. Web 2.0 is the network as platform, spanning all connected devices. Web 2.0 applications are those that make the most of the intrinsic advantages of that platform. Delivering software is a continually updated service that gets better the more people use it, consuming and remixing data from multiple sources, including individual users, while providing their own data and services in a form that allows remixing by others, creating network effects through an architecture of participation, and going beyond the page metaphor of Web 1.0 to deliver rich user experiences. Now, I believe that that very long and prolix sentence definitely means something. It is not vacuous or devoid of semantic content. If you are a techie, it's even a kind of emotionally exciting sentence. But if you break that definition down, what you actually find there is a roll call of social movements, of viewpoints, institutions, funding sources, and dominant personalities. It's about people who Tim considers important, and the stuff they do as a contemporary class. Stuff they do such as unintended uses, user contributions, effortless scalability, radical decentralization, customer self-service, mass service of micro-markets, software as a service, right to remix, and architected participation. Using web-based technologies that they are pioneering, such as blogs, wikis, voice over internet protocol, podcasting, filtering, sharing, social searching, and social bookmarking, with some nice on-the-ground cogent examples and public accomplishments to point at and publicly praise, such as Skype, Wikipedia, Katrina List, Flickr. So far, so good. However, there is room for verbal improvement here. Now, if you are a professor of the English language who also happens to be technically aware, such as Alan Liu, you can find that Tim O'Reilly sentence to be rather problematic. Why? Because it's not language-centric. It's too much of a techie banner ad. It's also too hasty. It is half-baked and lacks proper historical seasoning. And it's not social, economic, political, or cultural in its assessments. I will quote Alan Liu, author of The Laws of Cool, from a recent interview he did. I am highly skeptical of the Web 2.0 hype. There are two reasons for this. One goes back to the issue of history. Web 2.0 is all about a generational change in the history of the web, but from a perspective that is looking at what is happening right now, as opposed to what was happening during the previous generational change of the 1980s. It is not clear that we can really describe a generational change of this magnitude and complexity while we are in the midst of the change itself, except to say that something is happening that a future generation may decide is qualitatively different. After all, when people speak of Web 2.0, they are actually referring to a swarm of many kinds of new technologies and developments that are not all necessarily proceeding in the same direction, for example, toward decentralization, open content creation and editing, web as service, Ajax, etc. Okay, I think Professor Liu has a point here. A wagon train of pioneers on the electronic frontier, they are not the same thing as a town. And Alan Yu goes on about the serious semantic problems of simply not knowing yet what we are talking about, and even tripping up on some obvious philosophical contradictions. He says, "It is not at all certain, for example, that open content platforms in the style of blogs, wikis, and content management systems align with the philosophy of decentralized or distributed control, since many such database or XML-driven technologies require a priesthood of back-end and middleware coders." That would be you. "A priesthood of back-end and middleware coders to create the underlying systems and templates for the new, quote, open, unquote, communications. Just how many people in the world," that would be you, "just how many people in the world, for example, can make one of the current generation of open source content management systems, which often start out as blog engines, and make them do anything that isn't on the model of post or category or chronological posting? Even the more trivial exercise of reskinning such systems with a fresh template requires a level of CSS knowledge that is not natural to the user base." So what is Professor Liu trying to say here? Not particularly clearly. Basically, he's saying that in the guise of empowering users through all this participatory foo-for-ah, Web 2.0 is actually a ploy to return the Internet's technical power to the specialized geek clique that originally built Web 1.0. "They stole our revolution, now we're stealing it back. And selling it to Yahoo!" Thing link. That is the Wikipedia Jimmy Wales approved version of everywhere and spime. I discovered that term in Switzerland. I got it from Ulla Maria Mutanen, who is from Finland. I will quote her. "What is a thing link? Thing links are unique identifiers, ID codes for things. By labeling products with thing links, others can quickly find information about the thing on the net. Thing links can be put on physical objects like clothing, crafted goods, or places by using stickers and labels, but they could be just as well used online by putting a thing link on your blog post, your latest digital home movie, or music piece. When people find a thing link, they can use a search engine or an encyclopedia like Wiki products to find information about the creator or read reviews, for example. They can also add their knowledge and opinions by adding a thing link to their blog post or write a new Wiki page for the thing. Thing links come in different versions. Short thing links. This one is suitable for printing on physical labels. Long thing link. A long thing link is used for online things. Anyone can create unlimited numbers of these links without the risk of accidentally getting the same thing link as a completely different thing. And special thing links. Many products already have unique IDs, ISBN numbers for books, or EAN and UPC codes for most commercial products. Just look under the barcode." Now, Ulla Maria is an expert on handicrafts. I really think she would like to make a private, world-girdling version of thing links. And maybe that could happen if she could just harvest the heaving masses of Wikipedia to do all her unpaid lazy web labor. And I certainly wish her luck. It's a good term, thing link, because it's modest and punchy, and it is to her point. I happen to think that wiki is a pretty good coinage, too, because you don't mistake the word wiki for anything else. Now, here is another contender from Julian Bleeker, who happens to be attending this very event. He just wrote a manifesto about his concept. Blogjicks, objects which emit data about their use. Blogject is an object that is capable of provoking web discussions. It's a blogging object. A blogject, a kind of highly conversational conversation piece. They contribute to discourse. Not because they are smart and can talk all by themselves, because they spew up information that can make some difference in the physical world and get some track back. A spine is a visionary notion from 30 years from now, but a blobject is like a today's university lab project. You could pull down a grant for blobjects. You could make one pronto. Then you could see if you could get anybody to blog what you were doing. I blogged his blobject manifesto right away. So his blobject is already a kind of theory object. And if people started really making blobjects in real life, I'd get all interested. I'd probably write them up in Make Magazine. So I consider a spine to be something rather like a blobject, but a spine would be inside out or top down. A spine is like a blog that emits objects. Because as I said earlier, spines are manufactured objects whose informational support is so extensive and rich that they're regarded as material instantiations of an immaterial system. Spines begin and end as data. So if you had a blogject and it somehow created a really huge, very popular blog, wouldn't a natural part of that blog be the way to make that blogject? See, that's like a future version of today's Make Magazine open source recipes for building things at home. If you're reading my blogject's blog about how to put video cameras onto pigeons, let's say, then of course I will tell you how to put little video cams onto pigeons. I'll explain it in grating detail. Or if you want to hit my PayPal button, I'll just fab one out and ship it straight to you. And then we'll track it together on the web, and we'll all share the data as collective intelligence, and then Tim will get me to write a hacks book. We'll all be happy. Other similar terms of art I have come across lately. UFOs. Ubiquitous findable objects. Okay, I don't believe in UFOs. They sound like science fiction to me. I'm not buying it. EKOs, evocative knowledge objects. That's just another acronym. Acronyms are the small change of the tech world. Mobile social software, mobile appliances, automatic networks. That's the network support system for spines and blogjects and thing links. Probably some kind of handheld network interface, a descendant of today's cell phones, most likely. You enter a cell which is full of linked blogging things, and you just wave your detector around. Are they turned on in here? Are they powered up? What's the story? And what do you call this handheld interface for real, actual objects? A wand. An internet of things? An ecology of things. Those are the names given to the classes I was teaching at Art Center College of Design in California last year. Object hyperlinking. That sounds pretty accurate, but I always wonder about the lifespan of terms like hyper, super, ultra. Ultra compared to what? Object hyperlinking. Why not just say thing links? They're hyper, they're super, they're ultra. Ubiquitous, pervasive, invisible, embedded, continuous, ambient, tangible. A verb, to instantiate. An instantiation is the noun, a term which comes from computer programming and is now in a position to be applied to real physical objects. Spy chips, very useful and interesting term. Spy chips is the term of art guaranteed to provoke a fight. It is morally wrong to evade controversies just because you don't want anybody confronting you over what you are doing. There is something very snotty about an author who expects only good reviews for his books, and the author of an emergent technology is in the same boat. If nobody is dismissing you as hype, you are not being loud enough. And if nobody thinks that what you are doing is dangerous, you are doing something with no power to change the world. You had better fight it out with words before you fight it out with laws, because you'll be in no position to think straight when you suddenly get hauled in front of Congress and confronted for being evil.
Author Bruce Sterling from his address, The Internet of Things, at this year's O'Reilly Emerging Technology Conference. Distributing the Future is brought to you by GoToMeeting, online meetings made easy. Try it free at gotomeeting.com/DTF. Thanks to all of you who've emailed or phoned in your comments, criticisms, and suggestions. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@O'Reilly.com. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme. Visit David at batmosphere.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Bias Peak, and Audio Hijack Pro.